Early one morning in 1995, anchorwoman Jody Huizentrout didn't show up for work at her Mason City TV station. Her disappearance is one of Iowa's most discussed unsolved cases. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today we hear about the Huizentrout case and other so-called cold cases in Iowa. We'll listen back to my conversation with Beth Bednair about her book on the Huizentrout case called Dead Air. Then in the second half hour, my conversation from last year with a special agent in charge of the Iowa Cold Case Unit and Major Crime Unit at the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation. That's all coming up this hour, right after the news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Great to have you with us for this encore edition of the program. And this hour, we discuss unsolved, so-called cold cases in Iowa. According to the Iowa Cold Case Unit, part of Iowa's Division of Criminal Investigation, there are approximately 150 cold cases currently within the state of Iowa. In the second half hour, we'll talk with Michael Motzinger, a special agent in charge of the Iowa Cold Case Unit and Major Crime Unit at the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation. Special Agent Motzinger will describe how the state goes about investigating cold cases in Iowa. And perhaps you have a question or a comment about a cold case in your area. You can reach us by email this hour, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or give us a tweet at IPR Talk. First, we're going to talk about one of Iowa's most discussed unsolved cases, and my first guest is Beth Bednair. Beth is the author of a forthcoming book titled Dead Air, The Disappearance of Jody Huizentrout. She's a former longtime news anchor for ABC affiliate KAAL-TV based in southern Minnesota. She joins us by phone. Welcome, Beth.
Thank you so much, Ben. I'm happy to be here.
Now, Jody Huizentrout disappeared in 1995. At the time, she was working as an anchorwoman at KIMT-TV in Mason City. Tell us the circumstances of her disappearance.
Well, that morning, she was late for work. She normally arrived at about 3 or 3:30 to do the morning newscast of Daybreak, which aired at 6 a.m. Every day. And that morning, she had apparently overslept. Her co-producer called her at about 4 o'clock in the morning, which was about an hour after she was supposed to be there, and apparently woke her up. Jody said at the time, she said, "I'm sorry, and I'll be there as soon as I can." She was obviously thinking and aware. But by about 4:30, she hadn't shown up. Her co-producer called her one more time, and as she said, quote, "the phone just rang and rang." Of course, Jody's there was evidence, physical evidence around her car that clearly an abduction had taken place.
Mm-hmm. Who was the last person to see her?
Well, that's not clear. We have reason to believe that it may have been one of two people, and it would have been the night before. That's what we know. It's what we don't know that is a big question. Mm-hmm. The first person that we know was one of the last people to see her was her boss when he left. They were both at the Mason City Country Club having played in a charity golf banquet that day, and he recalls saying goodbye to her, goodnight to her, after dinner that evening. Now, she had not yet left the club. He left first, and then she left the club sometime later. One of the people that claimed was the last person to see her alive was the man she had been seeing at that time. We believe he was a close friend, but we are not sure of the clear relationship between the two. He said he saw her at his home after she left the country club.
Mm-hmm. What are the you see as the most promising theories about what happened to her?
Well, I truly believe, and I'm not an investigator nor a detective, but I truly believe after looking into this and researching this case that her death was not a random event, nor do I believe it was necessarily that of a stalker. Stalking is something we cannot entirely rule out, of course, because she was a a public person, a local celebrity. But there's reason to believe that she was abducted by someone she knew or perhaps had met face-to-face.
Mm-hmm. What did police find as evidence, I believe, in the parking lot outside of her residence?
Outside of her car, she had apparently made it to her car door because there was a bent key found at the scene, and it appeared that either the key had been bent from heavy pressure on her hand or by her assailant's hand because the key was bent. Also, there were the physical evidence. There was a hair dryer that she had brought along, a pair of red leather shoes that she was apparently wearing or had been carrying, perhaps, and a makeup sack.
Strewn in the parking lot.
Strewn in the parking lot and apparently across a reasonably wide area of the parking lot.
Did anyone witness anything around that time in that area that could have been connected?
Well, there are a couple of interesting observations from people nearby, but nothing is really solid. Several neighbors, a handful of neighbors, did attest to hearing a shout or a scream of some kind around that time in the morning. One neighbor described it as a sound of children playing in the park. But it was more, and others said it was more like a shout or a yell for help. And then there is an interesting piece of evidence that came from a woman who was running by the Key Apartments on that particular morning. She was a very early morning runner in the summertime. And she noticed an interesting occurrence about that time when a car came screeching out of the Key apartment lot and heading south on Kentucky Avenue.
Mm-hmm. It was foggy that morning there, wasn't it?
It was slightly foggy. It had rained on and off for much of the previous, about 36 hours. So, yes, there was some fog settling over the river. The river ran just behind Jody's apartment building, the Winnebago River. And it was slightly foggy. I wouldn't say it was full fog, but it was slightly foggy.
If you've just joined us, my guest in this first half hour as we discuss cold cases in Iowa is Beth Bednar, author of the forthcoming book, Dead Air, The Disappearance of Jody Huizentrout. Jody Huizentrout disappeared in 1995. And she has been, no body has ever been discovered, but I understand, Beth, she has been declared legally dead.
Oh, yes. She was declared legally dead, for legal purposes for her family. I believe that occurred in 2001, about 6 years after the crime.
Mm-hmm. Based on what you know, do you believe there are, obviously the perpetrator knows what happened. Do you think there are other people around today, aside from that person, who have information that would unlock this case?
I believe there may be. I would be very surprised if there wasn't someone else. I don't believe this was the perfect crime. I say that for one primary reason, and that is one of the things that I ran into in researching this book was very few people were willing to talk to me outright about the crime, and many more who did agree to talk to me said they would only do so on the basis that they would be unidentified. I think there is some level of fear out there or some level of belief that whoever perpetrated the crime will come back and retaliate.
Hmm. So you think there may be people out there who know who did this?
I think perhaps there might be.
Hmm.
Yes.
What other surprises did you come across in the course of your research?
That was the first surprise. Very few people wanted to talk to me. The second surprise, I would say, is that no one saw anything amiss for at least 2.5 hours after she was reportedly abducted. Now, I mean that to say, about 4:30, we believe she had left her apartment in an attempt to get to work. But really, nothing was discovered until 7 a.m., and that's when a coworker at KIMT called the police and simply asked for a welfare check at Jody's apartment because she hadn't shown up. Daybreak, her morning show, had already finished by 7 a.m., and a staffer at KIMT called the police to report that she never showed up, and would you run over to her apartment and do a welfare check? And when they got there, clearly the parking lot was a crime scene. What strikes me as funny is that no one, now there are three big buildings in the Key apartment complex, and this parking lot is surrounded by all three of them, mm-hmm. that nobody came out to access their cars in the parking lot, and if they did, they never saw anything amiss. That strikes me as very strange, especially if these items were, as people say, as police said, strewn in a relatively wide area around the parking lot.
It's been more than 15 years since Jody Huizentrout disappeared. So why write this book now, Beth?
Well, frankly, I was shocked that nobody has ever written about it. I have kept notes about this case just because I'm a former reporter and because this case shook me to the core. I've kept notes about this, and I've been writing things and storing them on my computer for years. I really never had the intention of writing a book early on. But as the years went by, it shocked me that nobody really was exploring this anymore, or at least to the extent of writing a book. And then others started to encourage me along the way and saying, you know, you're the person to tell the story, having been in a similar kind of situation.
Well, that being said, though, isn't it true that the case of Jody Huizentrout is the most, given the most publicity of all the cold cases in Iowa, and there are over 100 of them?
Oh, by all means. And I think, it's given the most publicity just because she was a public person.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not to denigrate the value of all those other cold cases out there and the people that are missing, but the fact is it does get the most attention from the media, no question.
Was part of your research looking at this cold case in the context of other cold cases in Iowa, how it is like or unlike other unsolved cases?
Well, there are small connections that I do define in the book. There are a couple of other cold cases. I do reference a cold case in 1983, when a young couple was found outside Newton, Iowa, on the Copper Dollar Ranch. I also look at another cold case of a man that was shot in his home, a rural Mason City man who incidentally happened to be a first person acquaintance of Jody. He died not even 3 months before she died or disappeared, and the connection has never been clearly made.
Mm-hmm. You did make the acquaintance of Jody Huizentrout as well, didn't you?
Yes, I did, on a professional level. I cannot claim to have known her personally, but as an anchor person in that market at the time, I was the longtime anchor of the evening news on the competing station. I had met her once or twice in our professional capacities.
Mm-hmm. Anything stand out about those meetings for you?
Oh, no, actually, I'll tell you right now, I just thought she was young. Well, as I say in the book, I thought she was young, pretty, and perky, but really not much different than any other neophyte reporter or anchor.
Mm-hmm. As you said, you were the evening news anchor at a competing television station, KAAL-TV, based in southern Minnesota.
Yeah.
This was more or less the same market that Jody was at. So at that time, did you give some thought before this happened, and certainly after this happened, but before this happened, that as a young woman, you might be in some sort of danger being out in the public, especially early morning or late at night?
Oh, you can't help but think about that. Yes, I had given it thought. I had been on the air for close to 20 years, and over the years, there are not only stalkers, but people that grow to believe that you're their friend, and you're essentially, you're virtual strangers. They believe you're their friend from their association with you by watching on TV. But many times those people would show a level of interest in physical proximity that was uncomfortable. And yes, I did think about that, especially late at night. I left the station late at night after the late newscast, and there were many times I would ask for an escort to go out to the parking lot. There were some times I would walk out there and just be hypervigilant.
Mm-hmm. You said you carefully worded that, interested in close proximity. What does that mean from people who would approach you?
Well, people would want to hug me, for example. People that I didn't know would want to hug me or, you know, latch on to me in some way. And I mean that. Yeah, that could be construed in a good way or a bad way.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is that they just wanted to come closer or touch me because they believed that we had in their minds, we had a level of a relationship. In my mind, I didn't know this person, of course.
Mm-hmm.
They were simply viewers. But people grow to believe that people on television are their friends, you know, and their trusted advisors.
Right. In a way, that's a nice feeling, but in the other way, it can be not so nice. Does that take, as an anchor for a TV station, a local TV station, does that take some getting used to when the first time someone comes up to you in the grocery store and behaves on your first meeting as if they know you very well?
Oh, yes, it does take some getting used to. And, I mean, most people learn to handle it very well and very graciously, and, you know, you greet them warmly, but don't necessarily invite a level of intimacy much beyond that.
Did you ever think, in exploring this case, I think you must have crossed your mind more than once, that could have been me?
Oh, very often. I would think there, but for the grace of God, go I, frankly. And many other people felt that way. I know it shook many people in the industry, not only locally, but nationally. I think it shook people to the core.
Mm-hmm. Did it change the behavior of local anchors such as yourself?
A couple of people, I think it did. I know a couple of close colleagues who it changed the behavior for them. They were much more aware. They were aware to change, for example, if they go for a walk or a run, they were aware to change their routes frequently. And just being much more aware and hypervigilant of their surroundings and what was going on around them.
Beth Bednar is my guest, the author of the forthcoming book, Dead Air, The Disappearance of Jody Huizentrout, perhaps Iowa's most famous cold case. How did you go about doing the research on this? You were looking through piles of records, I assume, as part of it?
Yes, I went through piles of records. Many of the items contained in the book are part of the public record. But also I talked to at least two private investigators who were involved in the case. I talked to a couple of her colleagues and also family members as well. I really wanted to get a three-dimensional picture of the woman that you really only saw one-dimensionally on TV.
Mm-hmm. Did any of the people that you talked to, the investigators primarily, hold out any hope of finding out what happened?
One investigator I talked to said that although he keeps his eyes and ears open, yes, he has essentially given up hope. There are other people, however, who I don't think will ever give up the hope that something can be found.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as we said, there were four critical elements that were missing from this whole scenario, and that is the lack of a body, the lack of a clear motive. Nobody can really define a clear motive for why somebody would have wanted to attack Jody. The dearth of physical evidence. It was only what was found at the scene. And then the lack of a real eyewitness, somebody who could say, I saw something.
Mm-hmm. What do you consider of these, or perhaps there's another one, the most significant unanswered question about this case? If we knew one thing that would unlock a lot of other things, what would it be, you would say?
Oh, golly, that is tough. I think I would say either if somebody found a body that we could clearly, through DNA evidence, identify that of as Jody, I think that would be helpful, the remains. And also if someone else would come forward with some information. I think that if I could name any legacy from this book, I would say it would be, boy, if somebody saw something, now's the time to come forward.
Mm-hmm. What does your book tell us that might not have been previously disclosed about this case, perhaps something you discovered in one of those interviews or in that pile of records?
Well, the one thing that this book does discover, there's several things, but one thing is that there is reason to believe that the roots of that abduction may have started in her apartment. And that is one reason I'm inclined to believe it was somebody who knew her.
Mm-hmm. Well, it started in her apartment. What evidence of that is there?
Well, frankly, there is one piece of evidence that has been withheld, and that is that the toilet seat in her apartment was found up that morning.
Okay, indicating a male may have used it.
Yes. Yeah, let's be frank. A woman living alone does not often keep the toilet seat up.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes.
Since this happened in 1995, how far along, how much of a role did DNA evidence play in this? Or was that, as DNA has become better and better and more advanced in law enforcement, does DNA, has it held out any hope for this case?
Not much. There is not much DNA evidence left. And what was able to be obtained back in 1994 was limited, or 95 was limited. However, if we were to find remains, that might change. Something might be able to be identified.
From what you could determine, was there any problems with the way the police investigated this case? Any mistakes that were made in recovering evidence, processing the evidence?
I'm not sure that there were mistakes made in recovering the evidence. I think perhaps that some people say that they didn't pursue the right avenues of detection. And frankly, I don't think that's necessarily that you can blame the Mason City Police Department for failing on their job. I think that's probably the case in a lot of smaller cities' police departments. There just isn't a level of expertise. But some people claim that the police only focused on the crime as the result of a stalker attack. Other people claim that they focused their time too much on one suspect, one person of interest, I should say. And other people say that they probably did as well as they could, given the case that they had.
When will your book be published?
The book is going to be out as of May, April 29th, so I will be promoting it the first week in May, and I will be down in the Mason City area in that first week of May to promote the book.
Does the writing of this book spur you to look at other cold cases in Iowa, perhaps write about them?
Possibly. I've been thinking about, I did really enjoy the process of writing the book and the process of digging deeper into one case. And, yeah, that's a possibility. I'm not sure what the topic will be yet.
Okay, thank you very much. Beth Bednar, author of the forthcoming book, Dead Air, The Disappearance of Jody Huizentrout, also a former longtime news anchor for the ABC affiliate KAL-TV based in southern Minnesota. Beth, thank you for telling us about this case. Good luck with your book.
Thank you so much, Ben. Good to talk to you.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Coming up in just a moment, we'll talk with Michael Motzinger. He's a special agent in charge of the Iowa Cold Case Unit and Major Crime Unit at the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation. He'll tell us how the state goes about investigating cold cases in Iowa. Remember at the beginning I said there are about 150 cold cases currently within the state of Iowa. If you have a question or a comment about a cold case in your area or how these cases are investigated, you can email us this hour. We're also on Facebook, or give us a tweet. IPR Talk is our tweet. I'm Ben Kiefer. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm Ben Kiefer with River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Today you're listening to an encore edition of the program. We're discussing unsolved cases in Iowa. There are approximately 150 so-called cold cases currently within the state. Joining us now to talk further about cold cases in Iowa, Michael Motzinger, a special agent in charge of the Iowa Cold Case Unit and Major Crime Unit at the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation from our studios in Des Moines. Michael Motzinger, Special Agent, welcome to our program.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me today.
So the DCI's Cold Case Unit website lists more than 100 unsolved cases. What has to happen for a case to be given to your unit to be determined cold?
Well, basically, Ben, any time a case runs out of leads, regardless of whether it's a year old or 5 years or 10 years, we'll consider that a cold case. And basically, that's how it kind of gets into our system. And then that's when we'll sit down and try to develop a process of prioritizing those cases and going from there.
So it's really not a length of time, 1 year, 5 years. You could have a case that could be going on for 7, 8, 10 years, theoretically, and still not be cold.
Yeah, as long as there's leads that continue to come in, we technically never do close those cases. When the cases do, it could be a year old and there's no leads, and then it'll become cold, or 10 years.
Mm-hmm. We just heard about the most infamous case, at least in popular media, Jody Huizentrout, the disappearance of this young woman. Give us a sense of the other types of cold cases out there.
Well, obviously those that are from Iowa and have been around for a while, you have the Johnny Gosch and the Eugene Martin cases.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those are the more high-profile cases, but there's just so many out there, it's hard to go through each and every one of them.
Are these mostly to do with just people who have disappeared?
No, these, a lot of our cold cases are disappearances, homicides, just any type of violent crime case that has gone unresolved.
So many of them are the case, are in the case where bodies are, have been discovered.
Yes, sir.
And okay. So these are people, missing people, or people who have been killed. Now, once a case is classified as cold, what does that mean for how the cases are treated by your unit? Go into that a little further.
Yeah, Ben, what we try to do is prioritize the unsolved violent crimes. It's a collaborative effort between, obviously, the DCI, local law enforcement, our sheriff's offices, and also we collaborate with the state medical examiner's office, the Iowa AG's office, and the local county attorneys. What we do is get with those local departments when a case is determined to be cold and try to determine what type of evidence still exists on these old cases, what evidence has the highest potential for any possible DNA evidence that we can obtain from those items that have been submitted to the lab. Obviously submit those items to the lab and hopefully get a DNA profile off of that that we can submit to the CODIS system.
Mm-hmm. How is that different than if the case was still under a normal investigation? It seems that would be the process that you would take there as well.
Yeah, right now we're going back starting from 1960 to the present. Iowa started its DNA program in 1994. So a lot of the cases that we're looking at that we classify as cold cases are those cases that have never had evidence submitted to be looked at for DNA evidence. So that's why we're kind of starting with the earlier years up to 1994 for that potential of DNA evidence existing that we're so used to seeing nowadays in all of our cases.
You mentioned something called the CODIS system. What is that?
Yeah, CODIS is the Combined DNA Index System, and it's a national database. Some people know it as the All Felons Database, and basically that's where people convicted of felonies, their DNA is collected, is entered into this CODIS system. And what we can do, for an example, out of the 150 cases that we have currently looked at, we've reviewed half of those, and on 23 cases we've submitted to the lab, they've processed over 2,000 DNA samples. And from those samples, what we do is then if they're good enough, we submit those into CODIS, and we've had 11 submissions into CODIS. And what that does, when they're submitted into CODIS, it is then ran against the All Felons Database in the state of Iowa and against the national database, where obviously we're hoping to get what we call a hit. And then we can refer those back out to our major crime unit.
Mm-hmm. How often does that happen? Is that fairly rare, a hit?
Yes, sir. Out of the 11 submissions that we have submitted to CODIS, we've had two that have come back as a hit that we've referred out to our DCI major crime unit for further investigation.
So are you at liberty to talk about those cases?
Not right now, because obviously they're now an open investigation, and so we're trying to go through those leads as much as possible. But I can kind of discuss a cold case that we did have some success with following the same process.
Okay, please do.
Back in 1986, Karen Weber was murdered and left by the side of the road in Jasper County. And part of that, obviously, they ran all the leads and the case became cold. DCI in Jasper County back in 2000 started getting some new evidence or some new leads, and which led to us resubmitting the evidence from that cold case due to the fact that that evidence had never been submitted to the lab. And for the agents and the deputies that were doing that, a profile was submitted to CODIS. And back in October of 2006, we had a CODIS hit, which obviously the profiles matched. And then in January of 2007, a Martin Duffy was arrested and eventually was convicted in September of 2007 for first-degree murder. And the other gentleman that was involved in that case that we got through DNA also died in prison while awaiting trial. But that's just an example of going back on these old cold cases, resubmitting the evidence that have been sitting in the sheriff's offices, police department storerooms for a long time. Mm-hmm. And resubmitting those and obviously coming up with a successful conclusion.
So this Martin Duffy had been evading law for 20-some years. Did you take his confession? Did he have anything to do when he came in to do that?
Yeah, I was actually the agent that went out along with Jasper County Chief Deputy, and we went out and talked to Mr. Duffy, and he was quite surprised that we showed up after 20 years.
Mm-hmm. So you showed up, and he was clearly surprised by you showing up?
Yes, sir.
And how did the confession come about?
We took him down and interviewed him, and throughout the course of the interview, he finally admitted to killing Mrs. Weber and wouldn't give us the other guy's name, but we were eventually able to find him through DNA.
Mm-hmm. So when we look at it, not only at the state level, but a national level, when a cold case is solved, as the one you just described, is it most often DNA, the development that leads to the breakthrough?
A lot of times it can also be people calling in that may have been afraid back when it first happened, and now they're coming forward because they are either one moved out of the area or they don't feel threatened by the person. And a lot of times we get information from the public that helps us solve the cases also.
When we talked with Beth Bednar last hour about the Huizentrout case, she said in talking to people, she sensed there was still a fear there. So you are probably a fear there of people to discuss it. Perhaps they knew something. So you are interested also in what's going on in the mind of someone who is withholding information about a cold case, right?
Correct. A lot of times it does, you know, people feel threatened, intimidated by the person. So you always have to take that into consideration when you're interviewing people on what their mindset is also.
Mm-hmm. And how can you remove that fear factor to get at the information that's potentially valuable?
Well, you just have to stress to them that, you know, it's very important that we hold people accountable and to bring those to justice that are responsible for these unsolved violent crimes. And hopefully, you know, the years have passed for these cold cases that they'll feel a little more comfortable in coming forward, and we can, you know, promise them we get enough information and get the person put away, then them or their families don't have to worry about it anymore.
Jumping back to the Martin Duffy case, the confession there, I want to ask you, too, was there he was surprised at being caught after all this time. Did you sense any relief in the confession?
Typically, sometimes you get the individuals that, you know, do show remorse and, you know, sorry for doing what they did. But this particular case, I can't really say that he did show any remorse.
My guest, if you've just joined us, is Michael Motzinger. Special Agent Motzinger is in charge of the Iowa Cold Case Unit and Major Crime Unit at the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation. He's been good enough to join us this half hour, coming to our Des Moines studio as we talk about cold cases, numbering about 150 in that category, according to the DCI. Now, your cold case unit has been around how long?
Yeah, we started, I guess I'll go ahead and start where we were at. In 2009, we had applied and got a National Institute of Justice grant. So we've only been here about a year and a half, almost 2 years. We initially had two special agents and one DNA criminalist out at our lab. And due to some personnel changes, we currently have one special agent and one DNA criminalist. And we are now operating under a COPS grant, which is a community-oriented policing services grant. So we've only been up and running since January of 2009.
Mm-hmm. So you're down from the three original people to two people?
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. Is that due to funding or?
Yeah, it's both due to personnel and funding. We're currently applying for another extension to our COPS grant to keep our cold case unit up and running.
Mm-hmm. I understand that the future funding for this program is a little bit shaky in question. Why is that?
It's just all related to the grant funding and what's available out there and what other departments have priority over ours when our grants go in.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, are you hopeful you'll get funding?
I think we're very hopeful. We want to obviously continue our cold case unit. I think we're doing really good work and taking great strides and hopefully clearing up a lot of these old cases to give our victims' families some closure and let them move on with their lives.
Is that something you've witnessed personally, the closure that a family feels when a cold case is finally solved, the relief that comes knowing who did it, how it happened?
Yeah, I personally, with the Karen Weber case, we were able to track down her daughter that now lives out of state, and just the joy and relief in her eyes knowing that the two guys responsible for killing her mother, it's just really satisfying, and it's really nice. We still have a personal contact, and she calls me about every holiday, and just basically comes a part of your life when you work some of these cold cases.
Mm-hmm. Speaking again about the families, the ongoing cold cases, are there different reactions with how, in regards to how families react to the treatment of a cold case that involves someone in the family? You talked about, you know, family members desperately wanting to know, get some closure, who did it, and bring that person to justice. I'm wondering, is there ever the case where families want an investigation just to stop because they want to stop thinking about it?
Sometimes you come up with some apprehension from some family members that, you know, they've either made peace with themselves and want to move on, but I think deep down they all still want the person held responsible, brought to justice. Mm-hmm. You do have a little bit of that apprehension on having them, you know, if it's been 20 years, on having them relive that again. But for the majority, we really haven't had any obstacles on a family flat out saying they didn't want the person brought to justice.
Mm-hmm. With about 150 cases, cold cases, currently in the state of Iowa and being only two people in this unit, how do you, that's precious few resources for so many cases, how do you choose which cases to go after, to concentrate on?
Yeah, right now, where we kind of started is on the unsolved violent crimes is the older cases where you may have something sexual in nature where the possibility of DNA is existing, obviously a lot more than a scene that doesn't have anything like that. So that's kind of where we've first are starting to concentrate, just to obviously got to cut down on our resources and prioritize things. So that's kind of where we've started from.
So where there is the possibility of new technology helping you analyze DNA that was at the scene in a case that had no DNA evidence, you would say, we probably can't help much there.
Exactly. Unless, you know, the general public comes forward with some new information, giving us a name, who they think may have done it, A lot of times if we start looking at these cases and there is no physical evidence, obviously those are going to be a lower priority than the ones that there is physical evidence that still exists where we can resubmit those to the lab.
So does DNA in a specimen, in evidence, get old? Does it a piece of hair or a piece of skin or something? Do you have to treat it right for it to be in good shape to analyze?
Yeah, there's a lot of things, without taking up the rest of the program, there's a lot of things on how things are packaged. If they're packaged in, say, plastic and it's moist when you put it away, more than likely when we go to get it here 20 years from now, the stuff is going to be degraded to a point we're not going to be able to get any DNA from that. So a lot of it depends on how it was collected initially 20 years ago, how it has been stored, you know, over the last 20 years. So you got a lot of different things that kind of play into the picture on what we have to look at when we're trying to prioritize the evidence that goes into the lab.
So moisture would cause mold. Mold would destroy?
Yes, sir.
The evidence.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. How often does DNA help exonerate certain people?
You know, I'm not sure on that question. I know, you know, there are groups out there that are doing that, and obviously I read in the paper that when that occurs, but I don't have an exact number on how many we've had here in the state.
We had an email asking about the Johnny Gosch case. Can you tell us about the involvement of your Iowa cold case unit in that unsolved case? Johnny Gosch, the newspaper boy. Can you give us a little background there, too?
Obviously, I believe that next year it's going to be over 30 years. Our cold case unit, obviously, we've been working with West Des Moines. We've been getting some leads off of our website in relation to the Johnny Gosch case that we've developed as part of our DCI cold case unit. And so we've been submitting those out to West Des Moines for them to follow up on, but we haven't necessarily been real active on that case at this time.
Mm-hmm. Most of what Americans, Iowans, think they know about crime and police investigations are picked up from, well, either fictional TV or also there's reality TV that now has a lot to do with crime. How accurate is that? Do you watch these shows? Do they give us a good sense of what's going on?
I watch them a little bit, but obviously when you work in the environment on a daily basis, try not to watch them, but I mean, there are some realities to those shows. I call it the CSI effect, and basically it can help us on cases because it is making people aware of what's out there and what we can process and what we can do. But obviously there's a lot of fiction to that when you're, you know, watching them get the suspect, process everything in 5 minutes, take them to trial, and convict them and have them in prison all under an hour. That's not real realistic in our world.
Mm-hmm. What if someone is listening to this broadcast and believe they know something about a cold case but doesn't want to be identified? Can a person give anonymous tips, be assured of their anonymity?
Absolutely. Part of our website that we created for our cold cases, it's www.dps.state.ia.us. They can get on there, go through the DCI link, and there's a part in there that connects you to the cold case unit. And you can look up and search by victim's name, search by county, or search by year. And part of that gives a brief description of what we have on the case. And if they do have information on that, you can submit information electronically and give us that information.
Mm-hmm. How do you determine success at your Iowa cold case unit? Of course, finding out who did it, as you mentioned in the case of Karen Weber, getting a confession. Are there other measures of success?
Yeah, obviously our ultimate goal is bringing those responsible to justice for these unsolved violent crimes, which has always been a priority of DCI's. The other successes I feel that I mentioned earlier, you know, of the 23 cases that we've submitted, over 2,000 DNA samples have been analyzed and profiles have been developed in all of those cases. And obviously anything prior to 94, I think, is a huge success that we can resubmit a lot of this old evidence and hopefully get a hit in the CODA system.
Mm-hmm. So when people are looking at the funding of your program, it's very difficult to say, you know, well, you've got to solve some of these cold cases, isn't it? You've got to have some other metrics.
Yeah, just because obviously you get a hit through the CODA system, then that basically starts a whole new investigation all over again, because now you got to investigate who the person is that the CODIS hit came back on, get their background, and you basically have to start a whole new investigation all over, which obviously it makes it hard. These cases are called cold cases for a reason. They were hard when they first showed up, you know, 20 years ago. They're even harder now, you know, after 20 years go by.
Michael Motzinger, thank you for joining us. Special agent in charge of the Iowa Cold Case Unit and Major Crime Unit at the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation. Special Agent Motzinger, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, sir. Have a good day.
You too. And that's our program for today. River to River is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. Technical support from Dennis Reese. And remember, podcasts and on-demand audio of River to River available by going to iowapublicradio.org. And we always welcome your comments and questions about this program. You can contact us anytime at this email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.